Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Anybody who listens to this podcast probably knows that there are a wide number of scholars who study religion, including sociologists, historians, political scientists, anthropologists, and the occasional religious studies scholar. We've all heard the names Max Weber, Emil Durkheim, and Robert Bella. But what about economists? Do they ever study religion? Have the likes of Adam Smith, Friedrich Hayek, or even the recent Nobel laureate Vernon Smith had anything to say about religion? Well, today we explore those questions and bring to light some of the thoughts and findings that these well-known economists have shed on the role of religion in our social world. To that end, I am pleased to be joined today by Professor Bob Subrick, an Associate Professor of Economics at James Madison University and the Associate Director for Free Enterprise at the Gilliam Center at that same institution. He writes broadly in the areas of economic development, political economy, the history of economic thought, and the economics of religion. He is currently working on two book manuscripts that examine the economic history of Botswana and Brazil, respectively, apparently in a mad dash to corner the market on studies of countries that begin with the letter B. Today, though, we will be focusing on a couple working papers that he has been circulating that deal with how previous economists viewed religion and how religion has impacted economic development. Bob, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you for having me, Professor Gill.
Hey, tell me a little bit about this program that you run, because economists always remind me that I or somebody else has to pay for my lunch. So I'm thinking that there really is no such thing as a free enterprise.
So the Gilliam Center is the free enterprise aspect of the Gilliam Center is a new initiative here at JMU. It started 7 years ago, and it was mainly focused on ethics and business. And it became, in light of the 2008 financial crisis, there's been a lot of attention at universities to try to draw on the ethical concerns that arose with a lot of these contracts and the financial markets. But recently, we expanded to look at the free enterprise side, where we bring in speakers from all over the country. We provide scholarships for students. We have a couple of student groups where we do a more intense study of ideas about free enterprise, the rule of law, and competition. And we also provide support for research for both faculty and students.
Mm-hmm. Do you provide free lunches at this Free Enterprise Institute?
More or less.
Okay. Yeah. Sounds very interesting. We'll link to that website for those of you who are interested who are listening to us. And we also have had a few programs on the relationship of ethics to business, specifically religious ethics. And so that kind of brings us to our topic today of blending religion, which does have many moral and ethical qualities to it, to the world of economics. And so I have to ask, this economics of religion, sounds a little suspicious if you ask me. I thought that you economists focus on stuff like banking and Federal Reserve policy, tariff rates, and measuring unemployment so that you can plug it into some multi-layered nonlinear regression analysis and determine public policy. What are you folks doing trotting upon the ground of all these sociologists and historians?
Well, that's a common concern about economics, that all we do is focus in on what is the Federal Reserve up to, what's the Dow Jones going to do, what are the taxes going to do?
Mm-hmm.
And I tell students, if I knew the answer to those types of questions, I wouldn't be standing in front of the classroom.
Mm.
What we really are doing is looking at social interaction. And we're trying to explain when people play nice with each other and when don't they play nice with each other. And we draw a lot of attention to non-monetary aspects of decision making. So traditionally, economics, people have focused in on, income and wages and things like that. But for the past probably half a century or so, economists have increasingly focused it on trades and transactions that take place within families, across friends, acquaintances. There's a growing literature on social networking, which doesn't have this monetary dimension.
Mm-hmm. All hail to Gary Becker, I would say, because he's one of the people who started that ball rolling.
Yes, I mean, that's partially how I got into this business.
Oh, really? Were you one of Gary Becker's students, or you read his stuff?
No, I was an undergraduate with no interest really in economics.
Mm.
I went to Borders, and there was a big sticker on one of his books that said Nobel Prize winner.
Mm.
So I looked at it, and I couldn't make any sense out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided I needed to learn some more math. But intuitively, I thought there was something there. These were papers about democracy, about marriage, about crime, and those were really things that interested me.
Okay. Well, what were you doing before you were interested in economics? What was your undergraduate trajectory?
I started off in political science.
Oh, I'm so sorry. As a political scientist, at least you saved yourself. You got out in time. So, and then you saw, so all I have to do is to save my students, slap on stickers that say Nobel laureate on some of my books or something. I guess that would be the thing that attracts them. Here's a question. So you started looking at Gary Becker's work. You realized that economics is more than just the stuff that you typically see in Forbes magazine of predicting where the unemployment rate is going to go over the next month. It actually has to deal with everything that humans do, every choice that we make, because we always make cost-benefit choices under scarcity. But this economics of religion stuff. So you went from being a political scientist to an economist, and now you're dabbling in the world of economics of religion. How'd you get involved in that?
It started with really two things. First, I have an interest in long-run development,
uh-huh.
why countries are rich and why countries are poor. And so as I was working on that a little bit as an undergraduate, but my dissertation, you end up confronting, you know, how much do cultural factors and specifically religion matter in explaining why places like the United States are so rich and Zimbabwe is so poor. Uh-huh. So that was one part of the story. The other one was when I just began graduate school, Larry Iannacone's paper had come out, An Introduction to the Economics of Religion.
Mm-hmm.
And that had provided, you know, a real grounding in economic theory to think about these types of questions.
Now, where did you do your graduate work at?
I went to George Mason.
Okay, and he was there at the time, correct?
He arrived my very last semester.
Okay, all right.
And I took his class for a grade, even though I didn't need to.
Oh, and how'd you get, did you get a good grade?
Yeah, I did. I did okay.
Okay, because I know him. I can go back and talk to him. So, yeah. So you picked up his paper and you looked at this and you said, "Well, that's unusual." I mean, it must have fit pretty well with your, you know, views of Gary Becker, because Larry Iannacone, just to fill in people with some of the intellectual lineage here, was one of Gary Becker's students.
Yeah. So we had some long talks about the relationship between Becker's thought and his own.
Hmm. Very cool. So you're doing this economics of religion stuff now, as well as all your other stuff. And I think, you know, I know the academy well enough that if you say you're an economist and you're dealing with things such as long-term economic development, why countries are rich and poor, you have some credibility in the economics world. But when it comes to telling people that you do the economics of religion, do you ever get comments or critiques that people say, well, you can't understand religious behavior, either because faith decisions are too valuable to be analyzed in a cost-benefit framework, or to religious people, such as clergy or the laity on a Sunday morning when they go into the side of the church building. They don't make cost calculations. They don't calculate about cost and benefits because they're guided by theological belief. Do you ever kind of get that stuff?
Very frequently.
Yeah. So how do you deal with that? Because I get that all the time, too. I have to admit, I am a political economist of religion. And it's very surprising, you know, when I say, well, you know, I do microeconomic analysis of religion. And people say, religion's too valuable for that kind of stuff. That's nobody, you cannot analyze religion in the realm of economics.
I have two responses, usually.
Okay, I got to take notes on these. Go ahead.
One is, I think it is a very rational decision that people make. I think throughout their lives, it lingers in the back of their minds, and they talk to people about it, and they interpret the world, whether it's consistent with their beliefs or not. I don't think people sit down and study, you know, massive tomes in theology, but I do get a sense, just anecdotally at least, that people do really think about this, because the consequences of it could be, at least in expected terms, really bad.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like decision to try some new pizza or something like that. Or you may, you know, we always apply cost-benefit analysis to those types of decisions, but the, you know, long-run consequences are kind of minor.
Yeah, and that's, I have to stop you there, because that is something that I always remind people of when people tell me religion is such an inherently valuable thing to the human spirit and human soul that it exists outside the realm of cost benefit economics. And I say, but wait a minute, isn't something that's extremely valuable, wouldn't you really want to take great care in calculating what you're doing, whether or not you should be going and how much you should be going to religious services or tithing or praying, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know. It's just, as you say, a pizza, you stop at a pizza place you don't know, and you say, let's give that a try. And if it's not good, no big deal. But take something like a house. If you randomly pick a house to live in, you don't like it. Well, that is a big deal. And same thing with your religion, I would guess.
Yeah, I agree. I think people confuse sort of some sort of academic study with this decision making than with just how people bumble through their lives trying to figure out what happens next.
Yeah. So that was one counterpunch that you have for people who come saying you can't study religion with economics. What's the other?
The other is I just take their beliefs as given. So I try to emphasize I'm not interested in making claims about the validity of the theology or anything like that. I'm just saying, okay, if people have certain beliefs, will that lead to any predictable behavior? So whether it be about savings rates or, you know, like giving to churches, attending churches, things like that.
So you actually take people's religious beliefs as sincere?
Yes.
Okay. See, that's another thing that I get all the time, because whenever you tell somebody, I'm studying the economics of religion, they go, aha, I know those televangelists are just snake oil sellers and money makers and money changers, et cetera, et cetera. And what I found is people like Larry Iannacone and Roger Finke and yourself and others really do look at some of these people and say, their beliefs are very sincere. Their theological beliefs about the afterlife or the meaning of life, et cetera, are absolutely sincere. And they act upon those beliefs in a world of scarcity. So I actually find the economists of religion tend to be a little bit less skeptical about people's beliefs than some other social scientists may be.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think we do accept that they say that's what they believe and begin the analysis from there.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to one of the papers that we're going to be discussing today and one that caught my attention. And the one that deals with Smith, Hayek, and Smith. And in that paper, the paper is titled Religion and the Social Order, Lessons from Smith, Hayek, and Smith. You say that economists have routinely neglected the study of religion. And in part, it might be because of some of these things we were talking about before. But what else gives you the basis to make that claim? Why do you think that such an important aspect of human life and religion has been around for millennia? Why do you think economists have largely ignored it?
I think first, economists have at least implicitly accepted the secularization hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
So as countries have modernized and have gotten richer and literacy has increased and education has increased, they've accepted the idea that science will be able to explain more and more things. And as a result, that will displace any religious explanation. And like I said, I think that's something economists, we don't talk about it very much, but I think that looms in the back of their mind.
Yeah, I think it looms in the hallways of academia. It's just, you know, out of sight, out of mind. And why would I put that variable in when that variable doesn't exist in my world?
Yeah. And then the second reason would be much of formal economic analysis is focused in on very short run changes. So if we change the price of pizza, how will people respond? And religion is sort of a slow-moving variable. And think of Gary Becker again. He famously argued there's no accounting for taste. They can be slow-moving and stable, and so we can kind of push them into the background. And given the nature of many questions, like business cycle-type questions or the Federal Reserve or lots of other microeconomic questions, it's reasonable to assume that, you know, preferences are stable and then begin the analysis. So if religious preferences are moving very slowly, it would make sense to push them into the background.
Yeah, I guess if nothing really changes, it can't explain any kind of difference right. That you observe in the world. Okay. Well, but you're one of the people who is offering this corrective, and you are the person to do it since you do deal with long-term economic development questions and even some short-term stuff. And as we're finding out, that religion might actually have an impact on economies even in the short term. But let's go ahead and look at this paper, Religion and the Social Order, Lessons from Smith, Hayek, and Smith. And I'm curious about that term, social order. Why does that appear in the title of your paper? And what does that mean? And why are economists interested in studying social order?
I think that's the question that has really motivated economics through the centuries. And the social order is, why is it that we see lots of peaceful cooperation? Particularly because we assume that people are self-interested, largely care about themselves, but they do care a little bit about other things. And also, when does that order break down and we have violence and conflicts and wars and things like that? Or to ask it sort of another way, the great economic journalist Frederick Bastiat asked why Paris gets fed. There's nobody out there, no social planner dictating that food move in the direction of Paris or other towns and cities throughout the world. So that's what I think economics is really interested in, is trying to explain how this decentralized world with self-interested people somehow get fed and get what they want. And this ends up highlighting a number of things, I think, including the role of informal and formal rules. So formal rules we talk about a lot, public policy, things like that. But then this would draw in religion and cultural ideas as well on the informal side, particularly thinking about norms and moral constraints and how people govern themselves.
Okay. So we're basically looking at, and I'm wondering actually, too, if this is one of those reasons why economists don't study religion, because trying to measure these informal social norms and values and customs is pretty difficult relative to, say, the formal rules that are written down saying, if you don't put up this type of signage in the village, you will be fined $300, etc.
Yeah, I think that is part of the reason why economists have tended to neglect these things. Even in the case of religion, a lot of the studies just say, do you identify with some group?
Yeah.
Without actually digging much deeper than what do they actually believe and how much this might affect their behavior.
Yeah, that is actually a very interesting realm of economics nowadays. More and more people are taking account of these informal rules, these social norms, and how they affect behavior. And moving away to some extent from the formal mathematization of economics, which has, I think, had its great deal of benefit, but it is also, I think, come at the cost of neglecting some of these more squishy, unmeasurable things. Let's go ahead and walk through some of the findings of the three economists that you talk about. And we've mentioned these here before with Adam Smith, Friedrich Hayek, and then Vernon Smith. Let's go ahead and start with Adam Smith, who I am sure most people have heard of, particularly with the phrase, the invisible hand, which, interestingly, he only uses twice in his two major works, The Wealth of Nations and The Theory of Moral Sentiments. Nonetheless, its invisible hand is quite often associated with him. What does Adam Smith have to say about religion? Because, I mean, if I go back to my undergraduate days, I remember reading an abridged version of Wealth of Nations, but I don't recall any talk of religion. I think you're making this up.
It actually is. It appears late in the book, so maybe that's why people haven't noticed it.
Mm.
It's in book five.
Ah, how many books are there?
There are five.
There are five?
Yes.
Oh, my
gosh.
So
it's in the last part, and it's largely, book five is a little treatise on public finance.
Mm-hmm.
And within that, and within a section called Of the Expense of the Institutions for the Instruction of People of All Ages, in other words, public education, that's where the discussion actually appears. So it's kind of a weird location.
Yeah. And one of the things that I recently did was purchase the entire two-volume set of The Wealth of Nations from, I think Liberty Fund offers it very cheaply, and was kind of surprised because when I had it as an undergraduate textbook, and I still have it on my shelves in my office, it was pretty thin. But it seems that whenever they abridge that thing, they cut out that stuff on public education or whatever he called it. It was always a very long word. I mean, I think the reason why his books are so long is because he just draws out his sentences so much. But yeah, it's in there. It is in there. And it's in The Wealth of Nations. That is one of the textbooks of modern economic history that we look back and we think about the self-interest of individuals. He wrote another book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments that many people are not all that familiar with. And some see his writings in The Theory of Moral Sentiments as Adam Smith being a moral philosopher here, and in many ways contradicting his writings in The Wealth of Nations, whereas The Wealth of Nations is all about self-interest, whereas the other moral sentiments are other-centered and altruistic. Is that a reasonable reasonable statement to say about Smith, that he's got these two contradictory books?
I don't read them as being contradictory. I think that books have different purposes. So The Wealth of Nations is saying, in certain environments, particularly markets, self-interest is what drives decision-making. And then in The Theory of Moral Sentiments, he's asking a different question. It's sort of, how do you behave outside of markets? What would be the motivations for your behavior?
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're both, it's sort of a broader view of humans than like economists generally take. So it's trying to say self-interest is really important in certain environments and in certain institutional settings, but it's not so important in other instances, such as when you're dealing with your friends or your family, or you're looking for approval of your peers and things like that.
Mm-hmm. So this world of religion that he examines, one of the interesting things that you point out in your paper, and you've done extensive work in reading closely both of these texts, Smith says that religion does not emerge as part of a conscious decision-making process. What do you mean by that?
So Smith argues that religion is an sort of an unintended consequence of people's behavior. So he's trying to explain the emergence of religion, but more broadly sort of reasoning and understanding causal relationships. And so he goes back in time. He imagines, you know, there's bad stuff happening out there, earthquakes, natural disasters, things like that. And so initially people respond and, you know, they get an explanation. The gods are somehow doing this. So he starts off with the world where polytheism is explaining things that can't be explained otherwise. Irregularities is the term that he uses.
Mm-hmm.
But slowly over time, he's going to explain how these rules get sanctioned and codified. And part of it is they're able to explain things that people can't explain.
Mm-hmm. And so this comes about in a text that, or I think a short paper. He only wrote two books, correct?
Right.
But he wrote a few other short papers or, I don't know, discussions of things. It came in the History of Astronomy. I didn't even know he had written that. How did you stumble across that?
Mainly I had heard that he had some discussion of religion in there.
Hmm.
The paper is not really about the history of astronomy.
Oh, well, but he called it that.
Yeah.
Oh, good job.
The broader theme, it's about philosophy and what he calls the connecting the principles of nature.
Uh-huh.
So what he's explaining is the emergence of explaining what he calls invisible chains, that, mm-hmm. you know, the social laws that are out there. Because he kind of thinks of himself as the Isaac Newton of the social sciences.
Yeah, yeah.
He's looking for these laws that will, you know, across space and time that hold.
It's interesting, that interpretation that he gives in his discussion of the history of astronomy, which, as you mentioned, is not about the history of astronomy. It sounds very anthropological. It sounds very social constructionist in many ways, that this could fit squarely within the secularization hypothesis, because religion is really the effect of our being unable to understand the world. And apparently, as we understand that volcanoes are not from imps underneath the earth, but are from plate tectonics, and that lightning comes from electrostatic charge in the atmosphere and not from Thor, we'll eventually get rid of religion. Did Smith have a sense that religion would disappear? Do we get a whiff of the secularization theory in his discussion of the origins of religion, that it might actually disappear?
I'm not sure that he would have gone down that path, because he sees religion as providing a framework explaining morality, where groups who adhere to certain beliefs, you know, they're tending to work out a little bit better in surviving, and those groups who have some sort of immoral standard are not working out. So I'm not sure he would quite go down this path of science displacing all the explanations and that we have for some sort of social order.
So there seems to be some type of evolutionary dynamic to this, is that the societies or communities that adopt religious rules of thumb, social norms, beliefs, values, etc., they tend to do well for themselves. They tend to prosper. And the ones that do not adapt such good ideas or values, they tend to weed themselves out or get gobbled up by other societies. Is that kind of where he's going with this?
That's my understanding of what he's arguing.
Okay.
Is as they get more prosperous, then they can begin, the science will begin to emerge as well.
Mm-hmm.
As people are not so concerned about just basic, you know, meeting and getting enough food and being safe. As these rules lead to some real tangible benefits, then you begin to emerge with some sort of specialization of people who will begin to try to put all these causal links together.
Yeah, and you bring this up in your discussion of what Smith was saying about religion and the theory of moral sentiments, where religion provides rules of thumbs for enhancing the social order. Again, we come back to the social order, how people get along with one another, cooperate, or alternatively end up in conflict with one another. Explain a little bit what he's talking about here, because, you know, these issues of, let's say, damnation and hell causing good behavior amongst people, you link that with something known as transaction cost. Tell us, what is Smith talking about here, and how do you interpret it?
Well, for exchange to take place, we need to know, we need to find people to trade with,
mm-hmm.
and we negotiate some sort of price, and then we have to enforce the contract. And where religion enters the picture, that's broadly what transaction costs are.
Mm-hmm.
And now morality lowers that, particularly that last part of the story, the enforcement question. So if I, you know, you're a religious person, and I infer that that also means you're more trustworthy, you're going to not breach the contract, you're going to honor whatever we negotiated, that makes it a lot easier for me to trade. I don't have to devote as many resources to following up, making sure you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. If in case of a loan, if I loaned you money for education, you actually use it for education, not just to go for a long weekend in Vegas or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So this helps facilitate transactions if, you know, people are trustworthy and generally honest.
Yeah, the world is filled with a great deal of uncertainty, and if you're spending so much time investing in figuring out somebody's going to be honest or what they're going to do with your trade, if they're going to rip you off and not deliver you the goods promised, you're going to waste a lot of time. In fact, you might even stop trading
right.
with them and just become the self-sufficient hermit, if such a thing has ever existed. And that is an interesting point, because in the class that I'm teaching nowadays on religion and world politics, we talk about the Catholic Church in the medieval European world. And one of the things that I point out is that the Catholic Church was very good at facilitating this. If you take a look at Europe in, say, the year 1000, it was a decentralized mess of hundreds of principalities, literally run by princes or people pretending to be kings, or maybe there even were kings. And for somebody wanting to trade with somebody in Bonn and they were living in Geneva, you would, you know, say, well, that's a really long distance to take your horse and cart of your goods and wares. But the one thing that everybody had in common was Christianity, and that you always knew that there would be a priest in town to be similar. And so in that regard, you felt safer, I guess. You felt more confident that the trade you made in Bonn and then returned home to Geneva to reap the fruits of that trade would be respected. Is that essentially what's going on?
Yeah, I think that's a lot of it.
Okay.
There's someone out there, some credibility behind these claims that you're going to honor whatever you said you were going to honor.
So that's just the institution, just having a similar religious faith that, oh, you know, even though we're separated by hundreds or thousands of miles, we share the same religious beliefs, so therefore we'll do better with one another. But you note that Smith and one of his contemporaries, Hume, mention that false religions can create bad ideas or behaviors that are not social enhancing. Hume himself was very concerned about this and argued for state-sponsored religion such that it would eliminate false religions. But Smith saw some problems with that. But what is Smith's view of bad religions? I mean, does he think that there are bad religions and ideas that could destroy wealth?
Yeah, he definitely recognizes that religious zealotry could be a real problem. It could promote antisocial behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So the group's very nice with them, with the members, but excludes and punishes those who are not in the group. But he's very aware that this is a problem, which Hume was concerned about with as well. that this would actually undermine, religion would undermine the social order in certain institutional environments.
Yeah, especially if there was a pluralism of religion and they were all competing, because again, they weren't that far removed from the great religious wars of European history, and I'm quite concerned about that. Even in their own country of Great Britain, they were, you know, remembered the Civil War and the difference between the dissenters and the Church of England. It's interesting. Hume comes out and advocates for a state church, but Smith does not. And this is the really interesting thing that I have found in my own readings that comes out in The Wealth of Nations. We typically assume that Smith's Wealth of Nations is a free market pamphlet or free market book that just advocates free enterprise, etc. And it doesn't do that all the time. But the one area where it really comes close to free market anarchy or free market anarchism is in relationship to religion. And I want you to explain this and what Smith's view about state churches actually is and what he sees as their problem.
Okay, he advocates the competition side, you know, like you said, a free market for religion, because he thinks that what people want out of religion varies greatly. So some people really want a very strict church that's very demanding on their time and what's expected out of them, where other people are kind of happy to go for Easter and Christmas kind of attitude. Mm-hmm. So given that this wide variety of preferences across consumers of religion, that Smith argues, you know, that means there's going to be lots and lots and lots of small groups out there. And if we don't have anybody who's the sole, any regulation in these markets or the sole supplier of religious goods, well, then there's going to be lots of churches, and the likelihood of any one of them being powerful enough to influence public policy and impose harms on others is pretty small. And so what he's concerned, when you do regulate it, as Hume had suggested, with some kind of monopolist, with a state church,
mm-hmm.
that you would get kind of what we call a lazy monopolist. With, you know, if you've captured the market and no one can go anywhere else, how motivated are you to supply stuff that people actually want? And that's part of what Hume wanted. That would mitigate any of the zealotry and other antisocial behavior that might be associated with religion. But from Smith's, you know, sort of idea, you're missing out on all that sort of the benefits
mm-hmm.
from religion, the stuff that he highlighted earlier in the theory of moral sentiments. About being morality, you know, the morality, the good rules of behavior, and the lower transaction cost.
Yeah, he has this extensive discussion about what monopoly churches look like, and he, writing in Scotland, just looks down the road south to England and the Church of England, and he has some pretty harsh words to say about that church, that their clergy become great men of learning and of high culture, but they often repose themselves on their benefices. One of my favorite phrases from that passage in The Wealth of Nations, where it basically, as you mentioned here, the lazy monopolist. Everybody is going to be Anglican. Wave the magic wand, Bing, you know, our mission is done. Yes, we do have to still teach the religion, show up on Sundays in the cathedrals and talk about that Bible. But on the other hand, you know, in a world where you don't have to, when you have some limited time and energy and resources, you might not be expending as much energy to cultivate the beliefs of the masses, so to speak.
Yeah, I think that's really what Smith is concerned about, is, you know, you have big churches with nobody in them. As a result, this important aspect of facilitating exchange, which really drives, I think, that's the big link when all of Smith's writings is, you know, how do we exchange not just goods and services, but favors with each other, you know, esteem, approbation, things like that. And by regulating the religious markets, you miss out on a lot of that stuff.
Very Madisonian in many ways is that you free up those markets and there will be a pluralism of interest in those. That
yes.
pluralism of interest will actually help to regulate itself.
Right.
You know, that's, yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, I think Madison took that from Smith without really attribution.
Ah, James Madison, our first plagiarist. It is kind of interesting, though, because Wealth of Nations was published in 1776, and Madison, who was a voracious reader of European philosophy, not necessarily continental philosophy, would have encountered this. But again, a lot of those ideas were percolating prior to that when, you know, Madison was debating whether or not Virginia should have a more open religious market. I don't think he used those terms. He talked in terms of religious liberty and not establishing the Church of England. But it's interesting how these ideas are all percolating at this moment in history.
Yeah, it's, I think it's remonstrances that Madison did on religious liberty in
right.
Virginia.
Yeah.
Yeah, it reads pretty, it sounds an awful lot like Adam Smith when I read it.
Hmm. It does. Although I think that came a little bit before. Wasn't that 1774? Or it might have been
1775. I think it was 1785, somewhere around then.
Really? Okay, so. I'm going to have to go back and check it. So maybe Madison was copying Smith, but so we'll give him some credit there. Anyways, I just know that those debates were circulating out there in Virginia at that time, so something to look into. Let's go ahead and fast forward our discussion a little bit, move up a century or so, to another person that you mentioned in your paper. And this one is a little bit surprising to me. I have read myself a lot of Smith on the economics of religion. And I've also read a great deal of Hayek. I've been very interested recently in studying Friedrich A. Hayek. And I did not know that he had talked much about religion. And he's one of these guys, too, that recently has been having a renaissance in growing popularity with this movement of Austrian economics. And most people don't know about Friedrich Hayek. First of all, before we discuss what he has to say with religion, why don't you tell us who this Hayek guy is? Because he was one of the earliest Nobel Prize winners in economics. And what is this Austrian school that he's associated with?
Okay. First, the Austrian school, they're a bit of a heterodox school within economics. And
they're a bit of a what? What did you say there?
Heterodox school.
Heterodox. Okay. I thought you said header, like a soccer player. Okay. Heterodox. Not orthodox, but heterodox.
Right.
Okay.
And they tend to focus in on the dynamic aspects of markets, and particularly this role of entrepreneurship, discovering what people want. Mm-hmm. So it's a very, it's not like your traditional models of markets where it's generally assumed to be somewhat static. And we assume a lot about informational assumptions. And this will get back to Hayek, really concerned about this. What do firms know? Do they know their cost curves, things like that? Or do they have to discover them in real time, that they're just, you know, trial and error trying to figure things out? And that's part of what Austrian economics focuses in on.
Mm-hmm.
And it also really stresses, and I think this comes out of Adam Smith a little bit, is the heterogeneous nature of a lot of human and physical capital. Meaning, kids go to college and there's all kinds of different degrees and they're specializing in all different stuff. It's not as if there's something called education out there.
Mm.
It's some homogenous unit, like we try to reduce it sometimes to years of schooling or something like that. But that misses out on what they're actually learning and what skill sets they're developing.
Mm-hmm.
And the same is true with physical capital. You can use, you know, buildings for many different things. They can be offices, they can be factories, they can be lecture halls, things like that. Computers can be used for all kinds of tasks, whether it just be writing things up or more processing data. All these things, both physical and human capital, have different uses. And the trick, according to the Austrians, is making sure it matches well.
Mm-hmm.
So students are learning skills that firms want to pay for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, houses are being built that people want to buy. If you think in, you know, the past couple, you know, half a decade or so, where we had this massive surplus of housing in the United States, where houses were built but nobody lived in them.
Yeah.
Austrians asked sort of, how did this happen? Where was the, why are builders getting this idea or forming this expectation that people, there's 2 million or so more houses that want to be bought than really were?
So it deals a lot of, with the diffusion of information and how that's actually aggregated into larger scale choices.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's really Hayek's major contribution, I would say, within economics.
Yeah.
To really sort of draw attention to that question. I mean, Hayek began as a very technical economist,
mm-hmm.
thinking about, you know, business cycles, really, back in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
And then through the 1930s, through the Depression, trying to figure out what happened. So that's the side that lots of people know about. That's the debate with Keynes.
Mm-hmm.
Also, probably around 1933 or so, he begins shifting his attention to more political economy type questions, questions about comparative systems, markets, capitalist versus socialist type systems. and really begins drawing attention to what have we assumed about the knowledge that the people have. Mm-hmm. You know, so we think about what do firms know? Well, we assume they know their cost structure. What do consumers know? Well, we assume that they know all their preferences. And he begins to argue, well, that's probably not true. That's something that's not just out there given that can be, you know, uploaded into some Excel sheet or something like that. That's something that we have to figure out. And he's really concerned that we've assumed the answers to many problems by the assumptions we make. And that begins him to say, okay, well, people don't have lots of information, but they seem to be doing all right. And how does this happen? And he draws attention, at least initially, to the price system.
Mm-hmm.
So what prices are doing are aggregating information up from millions of dispersed individuals all over the world. Your supply and demand curves that we draw like ad nauseum in the economics department, right, that's what they're sort of capturing in many ways, is information about what people, you know, what they really want plus what they think the future is going to be like. And the same is true on the production side or the firm side. They're forming expectations, right? They have information about input prices, wages, and interest rates and stuff like that. And all this information gets reduced down to this nice thing called a price. That way, so you and I, all we have to do is go shopping and say, if the price goes up, do I buy more, less, or the same amount? I don't need to know about why the price is moving.
It has just a bunch of information contained in that little packet that we see on the sticker on the can of beans.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, it's like when I go buy gasoline and the price is rising, I could go to CNN or somebody and see if there's a war erupting in the Middle East or, you know, something's happened down in Venezuela. Or I could just say, okay, the price went up, I'm going to buy less now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the really charming thing, I think, that what the price system does is it makes us a lot smarter than we really are.
Yeah, and it's very interesting that he's writing this in the 1930s and 1940s, because this is the time that totalitarian regimes are really seeing their zenith in world history. And you have places like the Soviet Union with their Gosplan, their five-year planning mechanism, where he said, well, we know what everybody's preferences are. We know what the right prices should be. We know what quantities should be produced and where they should be supplied to. And it didn't work out too well.
Right.
Yeah.
No. It's a lot harder than people thought.
So how does religion all play into this with Hayek? Because, again, I've read a lot of Hayek, but maybe I've gleaned over the stuff that he talks about religion and missed it entirely. I'm not quite sure. So I was very enthused to see your paper talking about this. But where does he talk about it? Actually, first, was Hayek a big religious guy?
Not particularly.
No. Oh, okay.
When he was younger, he claimed that he had developed an interest in Christianity, and his parents frowned upon it. So they hid his Bible, and then on Sundays started taking him out for, like, picnics to discourage him from attending any sort of church services or just studying the Bible.
Well, let that be a lesson to folks out there, that if you want to raise your child without the Bible or without religious services, they're invariably going to become a Nobel Prize winning economist. And we don't want any of that. So I you mentioned that in the paper. I just had to bring that out because I thought that was fascinating. Had his parents not hid the Bible from him, we might have had Hayek the theologian rather than Hayek the economist. So where does he, I mean, he's obviously interested somewhat, at least in the background of his brain, about religion, and he doesn't grow up necessarily a very religious person. Where do we find these writings about religion in his body of work?
You do see passing remarks throughout his career. And The Road to Serfdom, it's here and there. Sometimes it's buried in a footnote.
Mm-hmm.
That he's sort of saying Christianity had some important role in what we call probably the rise of Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, civilization. And you see it in other books as well. But it really comes out in his last book in the last chapter.
Which is?
The last book is The Fatal Conceit.
Okay.
And I think the last chapter is called Religion as the Guardian of Tradition.
So this
is very short, but it has a lot of ideas in it.
So this is the last thing he essentially writes. So it's almost as if he comes full circle with his educational experiences. How interesting. So what does he write in there? You said, what was the theme of that last part?
Well, what he argues, and you can kind of get a sense that he's reluctantly arguing this.
Okay.
That religion is really one of these important institutions that got us from our hunter-gatherer past to this world where we have a lot of impersonal trade taking place.
Mm.
It was the institutional mechanism that helped us to start trading with strangers.
Mm-hmm. And how does that work out?
His argument is it starts off that these religious groups, right, they adopt things, don't steal, the thou shalt not commandments. And you begin to see, tangible things are happening. People are leading better lives.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the credit, at least according to Hayek, goes to this moral system. So you see these societies are succeeding. And you begin to get mimicking of this type of behavior from other societies. If you don't follow these these types of moral rules, particularly according to Hayek, those that support private property and families, he thinks those are the two key institutions. If you don't follow those rules, well, then your society, your civilization eventually will disappear.
Mm-hmm. So it has a very evolutionary emergent flavor to it in many ways,
yeah.
Somewhat like Smith. Is there any evidence that he picked up some of these ideas from Adam Smith?
He cites Smith everywhere. So it's probably there. It's never, he doesn't tie it in, as far as I know, okay. To the actual chapters that we talked about earlier in those sections.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit on the idea that the religion gave sanction to rules of morality kind of stuff.
Right.
So that, I think he does cite, but pretty much I don't see the other citations in the Hayek's writing.
So he's essentially arguing in the same vein here that these moral rules actually help to lower transaction costs, to build bridges of trust across individuals, which makes and facilitates trade, which then I would assume allows the price system to work a little bit more fluidly, leading to more social prosperity.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
Okay.
That's why I brought Adam Smith and Hayek together on this, because even I think there's a lot of similarities in what they're trying to argue.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move to our third scholar now, and that is Vernon Smith. Is he the brother of Adam Smith?
No, he's not. He may be a distant cousin separated by a few hundred years.
Oh, a few hundred years.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. But I thought since they have the name, Smith can't be all that common in the world of economics, can it?
More common than you would think.
Okay. All right. All right. I'm just being a little bit facetious here. Vernon Smith is another guy who actually happened to win a Nobel Prize, I think about 4, 5, 6 years ago, maybe a little longer than that.
I think it was about 10.
10 years ago.
I was in graduate school.
Okay, so time is moving faster than I thought, but I did remember that. He is an interesting cat in many ways, and his work has been on the evolutionary emergence of trade and norms of reciprocity, among many other things. Tell us what he has to say about religion.
He doesn't say very much.
Okay.
I had never noticed it until his Nobel lecture.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was in graduate school, he gave a version of it at George Mason. And he had this sort of just passing remark about part 5 of the 10 commandments and how important they would be to facilitate trade, like Hayek and Adam Smith had argued, and build sort of this worldwide global division of labor.
Mm-hmm.
So his is not nearly as developed as the other two. They're more just a couple passing remarks. But what he does, what I think is really interesting, is looks at 5 of the commandments. Thou shalt not steal, covet thy neighbor's house, kill, commit adultery, and bear false witness.
Mm-hmm.
And he makes the case that those rules are very generic and generalizable,
mm-hmm.
and leaves enormous scope for entrepreneurial activity.
And how so, again? Explain how these 5 commandments, no stealing, no coveting, no killing, no cheating on the spouse, and no lying, how does that lead to more fluid economic transactions?
It reduces transaction costs again.
Okay.
It makes it just, we trust each other more. We don't have to devote as many resources to the enforcement of contracts, or we don't have to devote as many resources to protecting our house from invaders, or our cars from thieves, and things like that.
I guess so. If I was always concerned that my neighbor would be stealing all the time, I would have to invest in a security system and buy a bunch of guard dogs, which would have to be fed a lot of kibble, and I'd have to buy shotguns, and my family would have to take turns looking out the windows late at night to see if anybody's sneaking around the house. And that's, I guess that's wasting a lot of time. I could be using all those different resources for a lot of other things, like making political economy books or something.
Right. Or, you know, investment.
Yeah.
You know, and helping people get their education or skill sets that they need to raise their productivity.
Okay. I'm kind of curious, as you went through this in your paper and you mentioned the five commandments that, or the first five commandments that Vernon Smith had mentioned in an offhand comment in his Nobel laureate lecture. No cheating on the spouse. Do not commit adultery. How does that figure in? I mean, I kind of get no stealing, no envy, or no coveting anybody else's stuff, because if as long as you don't covet anybody else's stuff, you're not going to be tempted to steal, I guess. So that makes sense. Don't kill anybody, because again, you know, I guess killing is, or murder is, the essential violation of private property. Is your body is your own private property. And no lying. I get that one, because you need to have a judicial system where people will honor contracts and you can verify that they're doing that. But what about this no adultery? I don't get that one.
I think it gets to the contract question.
Aha.
If you violated that contract, does that mean you're more or less likely to violate other contracts? So it gets it. It's still sort of the transaction cost question, but it's getting at it a different way.
Okay. So if it sends signals about one's behavior.
Yep.
Okay. And maybe that's why we don't like politicians who cheat very much. I mean, oftentimes there's discussion, oh, they do it all the time, and, you know, it's just about sex, that kind of stuff. But I guess it sends a signal that if you can't trust somebody to honor that marriage contract, you can't trust them to build a healthcare system or anything like that.
Yeah, you'd like to believe they were honest on some dimension.
Okay. And you look for those little clues and cues to see if they are doing that. So all of this stuff, all the things that tie together Adam Smith, Friedrich Hayek, and Vernon Smith, is this idea that the morality, the ethical codes that are provided to us by religious institutions, help to lower transaction costs, help us to trust one another better. We don't have to, as you say, develop institutions of policing everything and guarding all of our stuff and junk all the time. And that leads to economic growth. And then that leads us to the next paper that you have written. And this is about religion and long-term economic development. And your paper about this really takes up the task of evaluating Max Weber's Protestant ethic, the argument that Calvinism was the one thing in Europe that sparked the immense growth of the economy during the 1500s, 1600s, and then onwards. Tell us about what your paper on religion and economic development is about, and if you did find this connection between religiosity, religion, religious values, and the growth of our material wealth.
Yeah, so what I was looking at is, was Weber right in his own time period?
Ah.
So I'm looking at before the First World War.
Okay.
The more recent evidence looking at differences in growth rates and levels of income in, say, 2010, you know, 2013, whatever the most recent data is, you're not seeing a lot of religious variables explaining much. Uh-huh. But I wanted to ask, well, maybe, you know, was he right at least in his own time, in his own terms? And what I was able to do is I stumbled upon some data for a much broader number of countries than most people had looked at, because almost all the discussions about Weber, whether this Protestant ethic idea was correct, that Protestant countries would grow faster because Protestants changed people's attitudes towards work, and they started, you know, working harder and saving more, and over time this will accumulate and cause the Industrial Revolution. The focus has been on Europe, particularly Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just not that much variation going on there. But I was able to look at about, you know, 50 countries or so around the world, which is a lot for the time period, and including places like India and China and some others, and get a better sense if Weber was correct.
Give us a sense of the time period again that you're talking about, because Weber essentially wrote from about the late middle part of the 19th century into the early part of the 20th right. century. But he also, his work, especially the Protestant ethic, dipped back a little bit farther in history. So he was looking backwards a little bit. So what are your time boundaries here?
So the date I'm looking at is from somewhere between 1900 and 1913, depending on which variables I'm looking at. So
okay.
like for GDP per capita, that will be 1913.
Okay.
And that's my main variable of interest.
Mm-hmm.
So I look around, and what I did find consistently is the more people who identified with Protestantism were associated with higher levels of income per capita, living longer lives, higher rates of literacy, higher savings rates, more industrial output.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, and I did comparisons with China and India and found the same thing.
Mm.
And it seems to me consistent with what Weber's big project really was. I mean, the Protestant ethic was only part of the story. He did write books on other major world religions.
Mm-hmm.
He looked at Confucianism and Taoism and Hinduism and Judaism. He also, in the book he was working on when he died, he actually had a little discussion of Islam as well.
Mm.
And all of them basically tell the same story, that for various reasons, Protestantism is more conducive to economic development than any other major world religion.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really what motivated me with this, say, well, is that really true or not? So I went out and dug up some data, and that seems to be the case.
And so you ran the regressions and everything, and that's what you did find in this interesting time period. I question about this, and I was raised in graduate school on econometric methods, and I'm a believer in the use of quantitative data. So I don't want to come off as sounding too jaded or skeptical about this, but to what extent do the measures that you have of GDP back then, to what extent do you think that they're really reliable? Or maybe you're picking up something else or something spurious that's going on? Is that, hey, they got the railroads by 1850, and that's really what explains it, not necessarily Protestantism. It's just a random shock that the steam engine was invented in Britain around that time.
Yeah, it's always a big concern when you do anything with these national income data.
Yeah.
Especially the farther back you go, the noisier they're going to get. We do, on the plus side, I think they are improving because we have lots of information on what prices were over time.
Mm.
And there's a lot of interesting research with economists and I think anthropologists and some other people from the other, like medical sciences, being able to look at remains.
Mm.
And so we know how tall you are when you died. So we're able to sort of back out how much, what your caloric intake would have been. And then mapping that into the price numbers that we do have, we're getting better and better estimates of these things.
Wow, that's kind of interesting. As you were talking about Hayek before, then the price system of how much information that contained, it seems like you're really leveraging that to dissect or disaggregate some of the information that was hidden to us for a long period of time.
Yeah, it's been really interesting to read that research where people yeah. are going through death records, mainly in Europe, where we have better records.
Yeah.
But at least we also have better price information. So we can get a real sense on, what would have income would have been that's consistent with their bones and their teeth, really.
Wow. That's fascinating. I've never heard of this kind of research. And so I'm a little bit more sanguine now about the efficacy of quantitative research. I just use a lot of big words there, which was pretty impressive for me. But very interesting, very interesting. So you're finding some evidence on this. And as we close out our podcast here, I give all my guests the chance to reflect upon their corpus of research over the past several years or decades and really think about what this tells us about life or what you've learned from this. Reading Smith, reading Hayek, reading Vernon Smith, the other Smith, and doing your other work on long-term economic growth and development, what do you take away with this? What have you changed your mind on anything? Have you viewed religion differently? What do you tell your students, and how do they react to this?
Yeah, it's been a big change in my thinking about development and lots of questions in economics. So I didn't come to this I was not remotely religious going into any of this. Mm. I didn't grow up in a religious household or anything like that.
Were your parents the Hayekian parents that hid the Bible?
No.
Okay.
Didn't no interest.
Okay. I thought you might have been Hayek's brother or something, his long-lost brother. Okay.
No, but I kind of went in with the Weber paper, I went in with somewhat of a preconception that nothing would be there. I'd collect some data over a couple days, plot out some data, see nothing, and move on. So I was surprised to find that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised to see Adam Smith talking about it, and really surprised to see Hayek talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
I've been engaged with his work since I was an undergraduate.
Yeah.
And, you know, reading, and I tried to read the things chronologically. And so that last chapter on religion being really important for civilization in some ways blindsided me.
Yeah.
I didn't really see that coming, because in other writings, he was very hostile to monotheistic religion.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the vibe that I picked up too. In some ways, I was surprised. I have not read The Fatal Conceit. I have it on my bookshelf, but I think this afternoon, I'm going to go back and read that last chapter.
And you asked about the students.
Yeah.
I have used The Fatal Conceit in my political economy class. And they really responded much more favorably than I anticipated.
Really?
Because I sort of expected, here they are, that these are all seniors. They've accepted one way or another some form of the secularization hypothesis. And a lot of them said this actually made a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
To think about it and get sort of what is it about religion that promotes property and family.
Hmm.
And so we've had some pretty good discussions over the past 2 years when we've talked about that chapter.
Very fascinating. So apparently, we might need economists to help us rediscover some of the important aspects of religion. And so all of you folks who think that economics have nothing to do with religion, well, this is certainly something to think about. And as your work progresses, we'll keep an eye on what you're doing and probably have you back to discuss more of this. So today, I want to thank Bob Subrick for being on Research on Religion.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.